The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker Daily. I am your host, Alex Andreu. Germany got used to the idea after the fall of the Berlin Wall that Europe was united and peaceful, that the end of history had come. Nowhere perhaps did Francis Fukuyama's famous saying meet a more willing audience than in Germany. Those were the words of Jeremy Cliff, who spoke to me recently about Germany's policy towards Russia. My guest today started his professional life as an analyst, focusing on Soviet as was security. He has led companies' Russian relations in both the energy and public affairs sectors, spent 6 years with NATO, and was the first alliance representative to be based in Moscow. He is an associate fellow of the Russia program at Chatham House and the author of a new book, Germany's Russia Problem, The Struggle for Balance in Europe. Welcome to The Bunker, John Luff.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
John, you started writing this book long before this latest escalation of the Ukraine war. In fact, you recently updated it. And I know that at the very early stages, you floated the title Germany's Russia Problem by a German diplomat. And the reply was, does Germany have a Russian problem? What did that attitude reveal?
That's absolutely correct. And to be honest, it was one of those things that made me think that I had, in fact, chosen the right title for the book. Because what I wanted to write about was why and how Germany had approached Russia, a country about which it was extremely knowledgeable, but yet it had treated it with great naivety. And this was the paradox. So I felt that the title had to be sufficiently provocative and yet to encapsulate the message that I was seeking to communicate.
Yeah, and as it turned out, highly prophetic. In the opening passages of the book, I was struck by the words, "Unlike Germany, Russia has not lost the art of strategic thinking." Can you unpack that for our listeners?
Yes, the point I was trying to make was that Germany had, by virtue of its experience after the Second World War, a divided country that then reunified in 1990, it had this luxury of outsourcing its security problem, if you like, its management of security to NATO, and in particular to the United States. And in some ways, the Allied powers at the end of World War II did not want Germany to have this capacity to think strategically. So it was farmed out to others, and Germany lived under the US nuclear umbrella. It wasn't a pleasant experience, of course, being in a divided country for 45 years, but Germany made it through, and the West Germans felt that many of their policies had been justified, and in particular towards the Soviet Union through détente, etc., and the country unified. And there was this vision of a future, a very optimistic vision of a Europe without a division, of Russia integrated into Europe. It reflected the euphoria of the unification of Germany, the collapse of the Soviet Union, the liberation of Central Europe from the Soviet yoke. And there was this sort of notion that peace was somehow inevitable, and therefore there was no need to think about the worst case scenario. We saw the German armed forces progressively run down to the point where they have very limited combat capacity these days, as has been, I think, recognized in many quarters. And Germany spent just generally very little on defense. And it reaped the peace dividend. And as a result, it was totally unprepared then for the turn that Russia took, really after, I would say, the Putin administration established itself, probably around 2005. That's when we saw Russia turning in this direction that was becoming increasingly hostile to the West and to Germany, despite the outwardly friendly relations.
So there was a time, you think, when Russia also believed in this sort of joint project of harmony in Europe, but that changed and effectively Germany failed to notice.
I think you could put it that way. In the case of the Russians, I think it was a brief moment in the 1990s. President Yeltsin didn't bear a grudge against the West. After all, Western countries had supported him when he stood atop that tank outside the White House in Moscow in August 1991. So there was a very different atmosphere in relations that probably lasted up to around 1996, sometime like that. And then the enlargement of NATO began to cloud the horizon. People in the Russian establishment became concerned about the degree of influence that Russia would maintain in the newly independent states, including Ukraine. So this was a time of extreme disorientation in Russia, and it was hardly surprising that people with a more traditional and I would say probably imperialist outlook would regain influence. And that's exactly what happened.
You devote the opening quarter, I would say, of the book to unpacking the complicated history between Germany and Russia. And you say that Germany's relationship to Russia is guided by that history, but not in a cold factual way. You suggest it shapes how Germany feels about Russia. Can you explain that a bit?
Yeah, this is a very, very important point. This is for Germany an emotional issue. And it's not just related to the Second World War and the barbarity of Hitler's invasion and the misery inflicted on vast areas of the former Soviet Union, not exclusively Russia, of course. It goes deeper. Because there is a great admiration in Germany for Russian culture. There's an awareness that Germans and Russians have a distinctive relationship. Germans exercised a very strong influence on the evolution of the Russian state, going back to the days of Peter the Great and particularly under Catherine. They are admired in Russia for their engineering prowess, for their superior organization. Germans feel that Russians have a degree of spontaneity, creativity, that perhaps somehow they themselves lack. And so there's almost a mutual fascination. And Germany has been so keen to try to feel that it's not in confrontation with Russia. It feels that Europe is not complete without the Russians being there too. At least that was their feeling up until probably 24th of February 2022. For them, this full-scale invasion of Ukraine has really shattered their vision of their bilateral relations and, in fact, the shape of Europe as a whole.
You devote another section of the book to Russia's influence in Germany. And it's quite striking what you say on soft power. Well, it was striking to me simply because it hadn't occurred to me so consciously that since reunification, there is a chunk of population in Germany that grew up as part of the Eastern Bloc. And so is culturally, linguistically, perhaps politically very close to Russia. Do you think Merkel's childhood in what was East Germany is important, actually, in that respect?
In her case, it was certainly important. Although she was somebody with strong transatlanticist convictions, she nevertheless brought this, I would say, instinctive understanding of Russia and indeed of Putin himself and the system from which he'd emerged. When she first met him as the leader of the opposition, of the Christian Democrat opposition, I think I note this in the book, she joked to one of her aides when she went into the meeting, he's going to stare at me and I have to hold his gaze because these people always try to intimidate you. And that's exactly what he did. And she held her gaze. And she was proud of herself as a result. And I think that's a very neat little insight into the way she approached him. She knew where he came from. And I think that he knew that she knew. And in many ways, that probably simplified the dialogue between them. But I think she epitomizes that generation of people who grew up in East Germany with a certain sympathy, and I use that word guardedly here, for Russia, for Russian culture, respect, most certainly. She would probably say that she has positive memories of going to the Soviet Union, despite realizing now in retrospect the type of system it was. There was no, I think, possibly unlike the case of Poland, perhaps, there wasn't this instinctive antipathy towards Russians or to the Soviet Union on the part of her generation.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
I've had it suggested to me that Germany's decentralized political model and tradition of coalitions plays a big part in its seeming inability to make very quick strategic changes like a US or fresh French president could, or a British PM even. What do you think of that?
That's absolutely true. And this post-war political model that was established for Germany by the occupation powers was intended to do exactly that. And it's been very successful. The result is slower, consensual decision-making. So in a situation that we found ourselves in since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine, I think Germany has politically found it difficult to move at speed. And even the very radical speech by Chancellor Scholz on the 27th of February last year, the so-called Zeitenwende speech, this wonderful German word that's now found its way into English. It was easy to find the words, but then to back this up with action and to start funding the armed forces to taking, the necessary decisions has proved extremely difficult.
Does that mean that part of our current, I guess, disappointment with Germany is a sort of global narrative that saw Germany during more stable times as an always sort of uber-efficient, decisive adult in the room, when the truth is that it is complex and flawed with strengths and weaknesses and slow-moving? So is part of the frustration a sort of longing for a Germany that exists only in international fantasy, actually?
To some extent, possibly, yes. But if we think back to 2014, I argue in the book that Angela Merkel, for all the deficiencies of her policies at the time, when we look back at them, she was bold. She led a European response. The United States did not give her a huge amount of support in managing this crisis around Ukraine. And yet Germany established a leadership position for itself. And, Merkel unveiled and she corralled the EU into supporting sanctions against Russia, which, we look at them now and think they were very mild, but at the time people thought they were quite tough. This was unprecedented. And she said subsequently that she had wished that they had been tougher. In 2022, Germany was effectively paralyzed. And that's because this was all on a different scale. And this was now a real war. It wasn't just some minor territorial incursion. Yes, we had the annexation of Crimea, of course, but at that stage, the Ukrainian army was not able to fight. Ukraine could not resist. It didn't have the same level of resilience that it had 8 years later. So this was an entirely different situation. The Germans were caught out by it. And we've seen, I think, overall, a very sort of flat-footed response. But they are gradually getting there. And I think there's a much deeper understanding now of the significance of what has taken place and what it's likely to lead to.
Someone recently said to me that Germany got used to the idea that its security would be provided by the US, as you suggested, its energy by Russia, and its growth by China. And it has been a really huge adjustment to recognize that this model just doesn't work with today's circumstances. It is easy to see this as a big error in retrospect, but did allies at the time make serious efforts to dissuade Germany from this course of action. I remember Obama being quite willing to disengage with over there. I remember the Cameron government being very friendly with Russian money.
Well, certainly the Cameron government felt at one point it was time to, I think, sort of bury the hatchet and just accept the inevitable that we should do more business with Russia, but it didn't really get very far. In the case of the Germans, they did receive multiple warnings, and most particularly from the Balts, their Central European neighbours, I think from the UK to some extent. But all the time, they justified their position by saying that, yes, we are going to continue buying oil and gas from Russia because we see this as stabilizing, that it's mutually beneficial. And for a long time, it was possible to sustain that argument that this was one of the foundations of Europe's relations with Russia. The Russians wanted the European market, gas market, for example, and they needed that market. And, Gazprom was exporting, about a third of its gas and earning two-thirds of its revenues from that business. But, what we've seen over the last year, and I think for many analysts, myself included, because I had a spell in the Russian oil and gas industry at one point, it's very hard to get your head around the fact that the Russians built up this business very successfully over 50 years. It was profitable. The gas business, not as lucrative, by the way, as the sale of oil and oil products, but profitable. And it gave Russia politically tremendous influence in Europe. And this has been thrown away, 50 years' work, in the matter of a few weeks. So Gazprom's exports to Europe halved last year. Its revenues in January this year from gas sales to Europe are 50% down on what they were the previous year. And it's very hard to see how this market is going to come back. Now, there are some who believe that German industry in a heartbeat would love to buy cheap gas again from Russia. If and when this terrible war comes to an end, we may see Russia selling more gas again to Europe, but it's not going to be on the same scale because people have lost trust. It's just going to be too risky. And in the meantime, the Germans are building, for example, their LNG capacity. And they've moved at immense speed to get these floating terminals functioning. There's going to be much more investment in that area. And this has been the ultimate wake-up call.
I want to wrap things up by looking a little bit forward. Do you think that Germany actually gets it now? I know you say that the changes have been implemented, which mean a diversification of energy supply, first and foremost, which I think is a lesson a lot of countries have learned. But is there a sense that Germany sees this as a bump on the road back to business as usual? Or will these changes be radical and lasting?
I think it's the latter. This is much more than a bump in the road for Germany. There's a broad realization that we are in a very deep crisis in relations with Russia because of the direction that Vladimir Putin has chosen to take the country, one of full-scale confrontation. He sees Russia as being at war with the West. And in fact, he has no way out of this situation in Ukraine. He has to keep fighting. And so this is going to go on, I believe, for a good long while. And I think the Germans are, and what I find quite striking is that there is a much more knowledge about Ukraine now in Germany, much greater interest, indeed sympathy for Ukraine. And I think Germany's sort of historical mission is, in fact, no longer going to be just the cultivation of relations with Russia. It's going to be the rebuilding of Ukraine. This is going to be a tremendous business opportunity for Germany. It's going to be an investment in its security. And ultimately, if Ukraine transforms successfully into a democratic state integrated into Europe, which I believe it will at some point, then this will fundamentally change Russia's position in Europe and I think will exercise huge influence and hopefully positive influence over the evolution of Russia.
One final question, drawing as much on the book as on your wider experience, I think. Some analysis suggests that the real issue in this case was that everyone still looks to Washington for leadership in these things. Is it time for Europe to take a much more active role in its own defence?
Oh, it's definitely time, but we've been saying that for probably decades. And the US has, I think, regularly sought to become less engaged, but each time has had to come back into the picture. And it was very striking to see, you know, President Biden visiting Kiev. The Biden administration has been, it seems to me, really very cautious in its handling of the war in Ukraine. Like the Germans, and possibly influenced by the Germans, very concerned about the perceived escalation, I think rattled by some of these nuclear threats that have come from Moscow. And it sort of almost felt as though the Germans and the Americans together would like to give Ukraine just enough weaponry to be able to fight to a standstill in the East, and then to encourage some sort of peace. Many Russian commentators pointed out previously that the Minsk agreements that were put in place and negotiated in the main by Angela Merkel in 2015, that were intended to at least freeze the conflict in Donbass at the time, that they could not be implemented because the Americans were not part of the picture. It needed the Americans at the table to do this. And I think there's frankly no escape there. Europe does not have the capacity at this stage to exercise that same level of influence. So it's very important what happens in the United States over the next 18 months and who will win the next presidential election.
John Lough, thank you so much for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
The updated second edition of Germany's Russia Problem is out now. Remember, there's a new bunker pretty much every day, so if you like our work, you can support our work on the funding platform Patreon for the measly price of a coffee. Just search for Bunker Podcast Patreon. I leave you with John Lough's words: Russia, in its current condition and configuration, poses a serious threat to the stability of Europe. Russia's authoritarian system is weak at home, and yet strong enough to be a revanchist power, one able to fill power vacuums created by the USA and its allies in Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Central America. The focus of Russia's leadership is on survival. This is Alex Andreu in the bunker, saying over and out.
Bunker Daily was presented by Alex Andreu. The group editor is Andrew Harrison. The lead producer is Jacob Jarvis, with additional production from Kasia Tomashevich and me, Alex Rees. Music by Kenny Dickinson. Art direction by James Parrott. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Papercuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Papercuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. Like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Papercuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Papercuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.